Accession number 18779, Reel 5.
Bill Pickard, Reel 5.
So, if his original instructions had been obeyed, they would at least been on the high ground, and I think it and had dug in then, it might have been more, you know, they might have... We might have lost a lot fewer people, but as I say, the Russians have countermanded it. And but I can understand in a way why he couldn't go against Gal, because I was on the phones. I was put onto the phone because of Spanish. So if any messages came through in Spanish, I could take them then to Tom. And I personally heard Gal shouting down the phone in pigeon, bit of English, bit of Spanish, and a lot of Russian. And he was threatening to shoot, to have everybody shot, be executed, you know, who didn't. He was saying it, talking about mutiny and all this sort of thing. It was mutiny if you didn't say. We had to advance, we had to advance, we only advance. People's army never retreats, and so. Now, all Winterton suggested was to pull the back up onto the escarpment when he saw the mass of fascists that were advancing on them. And, of course, then they got their field guns close enough, and the first that up were devils that had gone down and advanced onto these two knolls, one with the white house on the top that we kept referring to as Casablanca, but afterwards they called Suicide Hill, where Briskey, that's right, Briskey's lot were on the top there, and also Sam Masters. He was a sergeant, I think, at the time, but he sort of took over afterwards. They just pounded them with artillery. We were told that our artillery, we had behind us a French battery out on the escarpment with some 45s and an old English howitzer. But instead of using that, I don't know what they were firing at, because they didn't seem to have any spotters out in front at all. Every so often a shell might come over from them. But they weren't given any support to our poor devils that had gone up onto the top of this Casablanca. And of course we were higher above and could sort of see what was happening, and they opened the field guns on them. Of course they were all aiming roughly at the White House on the top, which was a farmhouse, which was a target, and it was the place where for some reason our wounded were being taken, you know, thinking it was giving them shelter, but it wasn't. So I mean, it was ghastly. Another thing is our blokes weren't, except for the few ex-servicemen, were lousy shots. And the guns were overheating. We hadn't got gun oil. That was the other thing. They hadn't got pull-throughs to clean their rifles. And they had two machine guns, Maxims. I think they were Maxims, to each of the platoons. And they kept jamming all the time, and overheated and jammed. So that half the time, their weapons just weren't working. Fry had some better with his group to support his Maxims. He had about 120 riflemen with him. Well, they'd been issued with some Russian rifles that were slightly, well, they were new. There, the fault there was, of course, they overheated, and also in the climate, we got a lot of the stocks splitting and so on because of they might be all right in Russia, in the but I wouldn't have thought they were particularly good there. But anyway, but the most of us had Austrian pre-war Austrian rifles, come from the old Austro-Hungarian Empire or something. A real bodge lot, I can tell you. And I mean, quite a number of rifles blew up, and we had casualties with them exploding. So weapons was another of the problems. And as I said, they were pounded. They didn't start on the 12th. It didn't start until I think about 11 o'clock, the first barrage. And we thought at first that the fascists seemed to take so long, but obviously they were building up strength, because what we didn't know was they were going to make a main push right through. They had tanks to bring across as well. And they'd captured the bridge because they wanted to be able to get some tanks across. As a matter of fact, they never used the tanks against them on the first day, but they did on the following day. But by about midday, those companies that had advanced onto the front had absolutely been decimated. I mean, really, we were nearly 600 in strength, and at the end of the 12th, I think we were down to barely 200, fit blokes. The rest was absolutely chaos. And I mean, it really shattered the English company for it. But Gal, I was sent later on. I had to take a message because our phone system kept breaking down. There were French and Spanish in charge of the communication business, and they had antiquated things. One of the Spaniards held this thing across to me, and he said, "You know, what do you think of this? This is what we're trying to use." The cable was all right, but the machines weren't working, and the noise, the static was terrific. So that was supposed to be our communication. Well, because it didn't work, they were sending out bike men, chaps on bikes and so on. But we hadn't got any, so if Tom wanted to send any instruction, he had to send a runner back. And I got sent back once, and I met, Russian intelligence bloke that was in charge, Shikolovkov or some name like that. A pleasant enough man. He spoke a little English. More French, very bad Spanish, and otherwise Russian. But when Gal shouted and told me that we were all going to be shot and I was to go back and tell the English captain that we'd all be shot if we didn't advance and so on, when Gal left, he took me on one side and said, show me on a map. And Nathan had borrowed one of our maps we'd drawn of the front. And it was left on the table at the headquarters, and I was able to slide it up next to the Spanish map they had, and showed the escarpment edge where they might have thought we were wasn't where we were. Our fronts were down in that bit below, and of course they'd come swept over. They were pounded in any case by artillery. Our supposed support hadn't come through. We were going to have avions that come over and also with that, but they never turned up in the whole of the day. They'd kept off fascists, but they hadn't come to help at all. So by early afternoon of the 12th, the first day, the Harama, I mean, we'd been really, really decimated. And the chaps coming back had come under heavy machine gun fire, because the fascists had come up on San Martin to Marotta Road and got onto the high ground, which we understood the Franco-Belge were supposed to be holding. But what we didn't know, the Franco-Belge had had a real pounding and had fallen back, driven back. We had, roughly because of the terrain, had stayed where we were and been sort of almost wiped out. And we got our revenge on the following day, up to a point. They thought during the night the remnants of our people came off the knolls outside, got up into the woods, and they were wounded everywhere. They hadn't laid on any proper transport to get them out. There they were being carried along what we call the sunken road that went through these olive trees up onto the San Martin road, and then they were waiting to be picked up. I mean, it was ghastly, and a lot of them, those who came out, left weapons behind, were so demoralized, I mean, not wounded, they'd vanished up into the olive trees and were making their way roughly back the way they'd come. Another thing to show how bad our discipline was, in the morning I had been sent back to find out why Fry's guns were taking so long to reach up. Tom sent me back to look at it, and I crossed the line that Overton's lot had just come over, number 3 company. And, you know, I saw a rifle propped up against the side of the tree. There were their blankets and things. Obviously, as they'd been coming up and they got hot and tired and one thing or another, blokes had left stuff behind. I mean, really crazy. And obviously, our discipline was in such a state, really, that nobody had checked it. Overton, for all that we thought he was fine, I mean, really was idiotic. I won't say anything against the others. Cunning was out. He was ill that first day. It was funny. He got what we call the grippe. He got some dysentery, I think, or flu or something. And so Kit Conway had taken over. But they were both regular soldiers, and they had a lot of experience. As a matter of fact, Conway and shouted his mouth off always. I mentioned him earlier on. He found
Overton?
No, Overton was the one. No, I want to keep saying Britain.
Briskin.
No,
Briskin.
No, big stocky. Doesn't help, does it? Stocky blow. I mentioned his name earlier on. Anyway,
he'll come back to you.
Yeah, he took over when Kit was killed. They were the best. They were our best blokes. They were party members, but equally they were experienced soldiers. Unfortunately, what followed on were party members. They might be good comrades, good communists, but they were bloody hopeless when it came to anything knowing military experience. And as I said, Nathan lasted until he was killed, but he was the only one really that, because he wouldn't join the party, you see, that was the whole point. He was a socialist and so on, and I suspect, though I don't know, that he began to see through what was going on earlier on and realized that the communist Comintern or whatever it was who was organizing it behind the scene, they wanted to be sure that they were going to be in charge when we won, if we won. If we didn't win, it didn't matter, so long as they got rid of any opposition. And they were more concerned, quite honestly, and fighting Pom and the anarchists, or those that decided anybody who disagreed was called a Trotskyist, and that was death to you. I mean, you got that. You were sent to what was called a correction camp, and you never heard of them again. So I don't know, so corrected that they didn't survive. But we afterwards began to realize why. I mean, they got the dregs to run the camp, and the Russians were a very different technique. Our blokes, I mean, we were really children when it came to this sort of thing. I mean, even our party people, I don't think were aware. I don't know whether Pollitt and that lot knew what really went on in Russia at that time, but they were wiping out everything. It was only later we began to realize that whenever any of the Russians that were over with us went back for any reason, we never saw them again, and we afterwards used to hear, oh, well, they were traitors, or they were this or the other. In other words, they went back to Russia, and because they hadn't done what Stalin wanted, they were liquidated. And the same, of course, would have happened to us out of it. But, I mean, we only gradually learnt, and as I said, I learnt a lot, yes, because I talked to the Spaniards, and I began to realise there. They, in the end, they just wished to hell that all the foreigners would leave, and they would settle their own trouble in their own way without all this, because it dawned on them that it seemed to be factions outside of Spain that was fighting its own wars on Spanish territory, and involving them. In fact, they probably almost welcomed Franco, finally, because if you didn't happen to be a communist, or sorry, or stuck your neck out too far and were known, you probably were left to get on with your lives again when they took over. But, I mean, they were ruthless. Franco, I mean, he was a bastard, because he promised an amnesty at the end to all those on the government side that surrendered. And then he probably shot them all as soon as he got them into his clutches.
But let's come back to Jarama then.
Yes, back on the Jarama. Well, the following, we still held the high ground there. Fry was still in his position and so on. And on the dawn of the next morning, we all sort of settled for the night down in what we call the Sunken Road, which was just behind. The other thing we hadn't got was tools to dig trenches with. That was appalling. We had a few old funny long-handled things, like rather like a hoe, which was a Spanish army trenching tool. But they didn't go in for trenches and things. In fact, I was on the phone one day, and somebody was jeering because I was asking for digging tools, and they said, oh, the Spaniard, he only needs a digging tool to dig a grave. He said, you English seem to want to dig holes to get into all the time. You know, it was sort of been disparaging, because we wanted to dig trench as a protection. And, I mean, they could be fanatically brave, but equally it was a kind of strange fatalistic thing about the Spaniard. And this business of sort of walking along the top of the parapet, the officer walked along the parapet, you know, exhorting the men to get ready to charge. Well, it's you don't do that with good snipers, and you don't do that with, you know, if your enemy's got a machine gun. So it took them a long while to get round to realizing that. And somehow our people had not said we needed tools to dig trenches with. So down on Suicide Hill, Brisky's lot at one time were using their bayonets to loosen the earth, and then their helmets, if they had helmets, and we hadn't all got helmets, to scoop the earth out to try and make pits to get themselves into. And they were up against the Moors, a crack lot of Moors we didn't know, who had a marvellous technique. They gave you a burst that kept you underground, and then the ground seemed to open up, and it was the Moors with ponchos on, you know, the same colour as the earth, and they'd rush forward and they'd suddenly flop out and you couldn't see anything again. So the moment our blokes popped up to try and fire, even if we'd been good shots, we couldn't, and they were getting nearer and nearer, and then the German machine gunners on the fascist side fired another round. All our blokes had to go to earth quickly to cover themselves, because half of them were out on the open hillside, really, and not proper trenches. And up would come the Moors again. And they would. That's how they leapfrogged and got to the top of the hill. I mean, age-old tactics, really. But we were really ignorant of the whole thing. And from Fry's position, you could see this. And, I mean, it was just ghastly, ghastly to see our poor devil blown to pieces there. Well, Fry got his own back. Fortunately, he'd got the guns working reasonably well. And first thing on the morning, apparently during the night, they'd taken the knoll and they'd taken the far right flank of us, our lot. We were off that already. Coatman had come back up with the remnants, bringing them up. I mean, he was a strange bloke, was old Coatman. He had, on the first day, he had a bullet half ripping his skull off. He'd had a bandage all round his head, blood dribbling down his face. He wouldn't leave the front, and he brought out the remnants on the second day. And Overton took over on the top of the escarpment now. We'd lost the lower part, and was so to watch Fry's right flank facing the communists. Well, during the night, they'd come down from the road and infiltrated up that shallow valley from the edge of the escarpment up towards the knoll where our front line where companies 3 and 4 were holding the front bit. And at first light they looked over, and packed down below was the Falange, one of the Spanish white troops on the bottom, all on the top. And Fry had an absolutely... We hadn't got any sympathy for him. Now, it sounded awful in a way, but he was able to absolutely mow them. They were running backwards and forwards. It was too steep to climb because our riflemen... Now, on the ridges that they'd captured from us from the day before, like Casablanca, the Moors tried to fire across to keep our riflemen who popped up the hedge. You had to be careful. But I think every one of us had a chance of potting off odd phalanges that were coming up the climb, up the steep bit. But Fry's guns, absolutely, of course, as they tried to get away, just mowed them down. But they got their own back. Overton's lot, later in that day, or the second day, Saturday, over on our right, he was supposed to be holding the edge of the escarpment, and he could have seen anybody coming. But they came under artillery fire from above the San Martin road there, because they got the passes had got their guns up there. We had two tanks or more there, and they were, and the Russians at that were supposed to advance down. At some point they turned and withdraw. Either they thought they were going to be outflanked or something, and they must save the tanks. I don't know what it did. They left us completely exposed. We weren't told this. The Franco-Belgians had already, the day before, fallen back. So we were like a salient, sticking out. I mean, militarily, it was crazy. Tom, I know, kept worrying about being outflanked over on our left side to the south. And, of course, it was an obvious one. if the fascists who had come across the river and then attacked up, if it had carried on round that side, they could have outflanked us and come up there. And I think they sent some of the Lister Brigade, Spaniards, to hold that side. But they never arrived until either it was either on the first day or the second day. The first we knew, some came through the olives at the back and started firing at us. And they didn't know that was us. They were so vague about where they thought they were going. They said they'd come to help, to support the English and so on. And fortunately, they didn't kill any of us because we were down below. And we got the teniente when he'd finished his lunch. He wasn't going to hurry himself to move over and try and look after our left flank, which is completely exposed. If the fascists had realized that, they could have swept us out in 5 minutes on that first day. But fortunately for us, they didn't realize how weak we were there. But they threw everything else at us during the course of the day, and all we were being told over when the messages came through, we had to advance, we had to hold, we had to advance. Poor old Nathan, he tried to get support up to us from headquarters, and he came down a couple of times riding pillion on the back of a dispatch rider's thing, still immaculate, still with only his stick. He used to cheer us just to see him. He used to come down, he used to sound so, you know, nonsense. It's a bit of a party, isn't it? You know, you're having fun here, are you, sort of thing, comrade. But we couldn't help laughing, and it did sort of cheer us up a little bit, I must say. Well, Overton had the job of defending Fry on the second day, and of course he comes under artillery fire, and without instructions or telling everybody, pulls back into the olives and well back. He could no longer see what was happening, and they got Moors. Not Falange, not Spanish soldiers, Moros coming up. And our blokes didn't... wait a moment, no, I must get this right. That was the point. If it had been Moors, they would have known they were enemy. But they weren't. They were Falange that came up. And their uniforms were a bit different. And they came up onto the top and sang the International. And, of course, our chaps let them come right up walking up the trench, as you see. So they were right on top of us. And then, of course... out came hand grenades, and they blasted us, and Fry was captured. Those that got away from that fell back. I was in the sunken road by the phones at the time while it was happening, and Tom or one of them sent the scouts up to see what was happening up with Fry, and of course they just came up over the rise near the thing, and they were immediately fired on, because they turned the machine guns on us. Then they turned them round and used our own machine guns on, of course, and pinned us down in the sunken road. So everybody else had to sort of gather there. It was the only area so we lost the top, but we still held on. The remnants of us came back and gathered in the sunken road. We were still trying to get from the previous day wounded. I mean, really, a lot of blokes lost their lives if they'd been moved out, proper medical treatment at once and so on, begging. And they were crying through the night for water and things like that. That was our own inefficiency. No proper, you know, we were expendable. That was really, that was their attitude as far as headquarters were concerned. Now, our people, our officers, though party members or not, I think ought to have stood out on behalf of everybody, rather than allowing party discipline come, if you like, military discipline, silence them and make them obey every order coming down the line. That's where I got no time for their attitude at all. People's war or not people's war, I mean, you know, you're dealing with hard facts there. And to have a sort of theory of war, I don't know, I never could bother to see what Karl Marx, if he ever did say anything about fighting. I think he talked about revolution and so on, but I don't think he just talked about when it came to war in the field. And of course, the Russians did it themselves afterwards, I mean, against Hitler. I mean, their infantry and things were expendable in their eyes. They might try to safeguard their tanks as long as they possibly could, but as far as the ordinary soldier was concerned, he was expendable. And I mean, and the discipline was ruthless, as you probably know. All right, we could sneer at our own forces, but at least when we went to war afterwards, we did try to keep casualties down as much as possible, where we could. And I know when, afterwards, when I was in the British Army and I was with the KR, see, up in the East African campaign, and then later in Burma. I mean, we used training to the very best ability. We had, when we went into the jungle, we had crazy characters like, what's his name? Who was ran the Chindits?
Wingert. But let's come back to Harama, though.
Yes.
You were just talking about the capture of Fry. And
oh yes, that was towards the end of the second day, and that was really the end of that. They'd started to were holding what we call the sunken road. Now about I suppose a quarter of a mile back, they'd already decided that we were going to have a line of trenches, and they'd set civilians to start digging a sort of trench thing. Now for about 2 days, I think. Maybe, perhaps it was three. We held the sunken road, and what finally defeated them? They came. They got a tank, two tanks, I think. The fascists sent up the San Martin road, and they turned round and they caught us in the side. I was back either at Chinchon or something. Anyway, we came rushing back to try and hold the lot. And another little thing that happened. That's right, Cunningham. By that time, was over his flu, I think. Tom, that's right. Tom led a charge. Tom led a charge on that second day to try and recapture the guns that had been captured by Fry, and that's when he got it in the hip, and we those that went with him over the top. And this is another of the strange things. It was apparently Overton who had been cowardly at one moment in pulling his people back and allowing them to get to the phalange, get up to the top escarpment and capture them. Afterwards, it was one of those who suggested and apparently went with Tom Winchington in this charge to try and capture the guns. But of course, they rushed in a pack, and of course, they were caught the moment they came over the rise amongst the olives, which by that time were getting shattered to pieces. They didn't offer any shelter at all, because I mean all the tops are gone already with just the machine guns moving backwards and forwards. It was like a scythe cutting through the trees. And so Tom got it and was taken out. So that was the end. We never saw him again. He went back to Albacete and later on started an officer's training thing for us down there or something like that. But in that period, the end of the first day, he didn't seem to be able to know what was happening at all. It was Aitken, Commissar Aitken, who was the one that really tried to pull us together and got us together in the sunken road and hold that position and pass out ammo to everybody and gave us enough pep talk to chaps who were pretty shaken. To come and really make a bit of a stand. But then Aitken, who was in charge when Tom was taken away on the second day, and as I say, we didn't see him again, and then Cunningham, who'd come back from ill though he was. Actually, he was the one, I think, who met a whole group of chaps who'd got back to what we used to refer to as the Finca, was where our battalion HQ was, in this farm place. And he met a whole group of them, and he said, you know, roused them out. There's a funny story told about him. Apparently, there was a wine cellar behind this Finca. They'd obviously had, you know, grown grapes. They had grapes and things on up on the side, as well as olives, and one of the things they'd done was made wines, and they had, but the estate was owned by some bloke, I think, who was a painter, or had a Spanish painter as a friend, and the house had a lot of his paintings in, but the big wine jars had nude figures, rather pornographic things he painted on this thing, which you can imagine have fascinated the lads and so on. Now, when Cunningham was rousing up everybody he could find, some buggers had gone and got inside some of them to hide. They didn't want to go back up the line. And the story, I wasn't there, it was told afterwards and passed around.